For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, you're going to be taken into the heart of Appalachia, West Virginia more specifically, and even more specifically than that, Pocahontas County, and to a part of the United States that has come to be known more and more by more and more Americans as a fascinating place in which there is a profound kind of quiet, or at least that is what is believed to be the case with Green Bank, West Virginia, a community which is home to the Green Bank Observatory. And there are laws in place which ban a number of different modern devices that most of us take for granted. That law, which creates a sort of radio silence in the region, or is intended to, means that life is very different for those who live in this interesting region. And Stephen Kersey, who is an award-winning journalist, decided to visit this remarkable place, Green Bank, West Virginia, and its surrounding area, to explore it on his own, to maybe find out if it is indeed as quiet as it is sort of proclaimed to be. And what he actually found was a place and its people far more fascinating than I think he probably anticipated going in. And the book that he has written about this this part of West Virginia is called The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. Stephen Kersey's work as a journalist has appeared in the Christian Science Monitor, the New Yorker magazine, the New York Times, among others. This book is published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow, again titled The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. Stephen Kersey, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
I'm really excited to be speaking with you. I absolutely love the book. And the book, like Green Bank, West Virginia, has more to it than meets the eye. So I really appreciate that. One of the stories that I think we need to tackle right off the bat is your own relationship with technologies such as the smartphone, which so many of us regard as all but indispensable in our daily lives. You do not. You tell us at one point in the book, "My journey to the quiet zone began back in 2009 when I got rid of my first and last cell phone." Explain where you were, I don't mean geographically so much as emotionally and mentally, in 2009 that led you to do such a thing.
Well, geographically, I was actually in the capital of Cambodia, in Phnom Penh. I'd been working for the Cambodia Daily for a couple of years, and being like a regional correspondent for various United States publications. And I was going to be traveling across Asia for a couple of months, and I just decided I don't need this device anymore. It was a device that I felt had kind of taken a little bit more control over my life than I would have liked. Like, I can remember sitting in the newsroom at the end of a day of reporting and literally like staring at the device, willing for it to ring, so that it would give me that last quote I needed so that I could submit my story on time. I can remember like going to bed, holding the phone in my hand, you know, just so I could respond to like my editor's last minute questions if he had any on the articles that I'd submitted that evening. It was like an unhealthy relationship. I wanted a break from the device, and I also knew that the device just wouldn't be working as I traveled across Asia. When I got back to the United States, I decided just to save a few bucks by not getting a new phone and by not getting, you know, a several hundred dollar a month, you know, phone plan for the next fancy gadget or whatever. And that initial kind of trivial decision morphed into more like an obstinate refusal to get this device that everybody around me was increasingly carrying around, and more people were telling me I just had to get if I wanted to be part of modern society. That went from a boss who told me get a smartphone and get on Facebook if I wanted to be a journalist. I declined both directives, to my mother saying, can't you please just get a smartphone so that I know where you are when you're going for these 100-mile bicycle rides? I don't have to worry about you as much. It seemed like unnecessary, in my opinion, that all of a sudden I'd be available to others at any minute of my life. And I've kept up that decision to the point where I started to wonder, like, where do I belong in this world where 97% of Americans have cell phones and most of them have smartphones? Are there other people like me out there? Is there a place where we can still go and cell service just doesn't exist and maybe people live like a bit of a slower paced life?
I really find intriguing what you write about this decision that you made and about the pervasiveness of some of these digital technologies in our lives. You actually quote an author who I interviewed on this very program, Nicholas Carr, who wrote a book called The Shadows, which, among other things, talks about the importance of quiet. And it sounds like that's one of the things that for which you were seeking, a certain kind of quiet that you found to be impossible to attain if one is tethered to a smartphone 24/7.
That's right. Yeah, I'm flipping through the book right now trying to find that quote from Nicholas Carr. He's just one of a number of, you know, smart people who have done a lot of research into this area and have found that what these devices are doing to our brains and to our ability to concentrate is not productive. and it seemed like if we go into a quiet zone, a place where there are actual laws against electromagnetic radiation and how connected we can actually be, maybe this would be a place where people are more productive because they're less connected from their devices. Maybe this is like a physical, real, live place that could be tested, that where you can test whether or not, you know, these assertions by Nicholas Carr and Sherry Turkle and Jean Twang and other researchers in this area are actually bearing fruit. Mm. Are people in the quiet zone happier? Are they more productive? Do they get in less car accidents? Because it just can't be, you know, texting and driving at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into your specific entrance into this quiet zone of Green Bank, West Virginia, I want to ask you about one other thing that you say in this portion of the book, and I think these words are your own. I don't think you're quoting somebody else. When you say, so much of the digital world was designed or is designed to make us feel dissatisfied. I mean, as somebody who is very much connected to these technologies that you're talking about, I mean, probably less than some, but more than others, and can't imagine life without them, I nevertheless sense profound truth in what you're saying there. What do you think is behind this way in which the digital world makes us feel dissatisfied? Dissatisfied in what way?
So much of the online world is designed to make us buy something. It's designed to make us want or crave something, right? Like you're on Twitter or other social media, and there are influencers there who are kind of subversively trying to get you to buy what they're wearing or the product that they've been, you know, secretly told to sell, be it like a bathing suit they're wearing or a hat that they're wearing or a designer brand that they have on. So much of what we even see on Facebook or Instagram are pictures of other people having fun, looking like they're having the time of their lives. And when in reality, we know that everybody struggles with the same things. Everybody has down moments, but you don't put those things online, right? And so for people who are outside of that, you look at it and you think, why am I not there at that party having the time of my life right now, right? Or why don't I have that fancy device that's popping up? Google, you know, I use Gmail, and Google does a keyword search of all my emails, and I'll start seeing ads pop up when I surf the web afterward. It's trying to sell those things back to me, trying to discern my wants and desires and to sell it back to me. Everything is so designed to make a buck off of what these advertisers think we might want. And that's what I mean when I say so much of the web is designed to make us feel dissatisfied, to make us want and crave something else. And that's never going to stop. There's always more to want and crave.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Stephen Kersey about his new book called The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. So as somebody who was committed to and already for years had been committed to the notion of disconnecting yourself from this digital world, or at least to a very, very large extent, you decided that you wanted to visit a place where such disconnection was not going to be viewed as abnormal, but would actually be the normal in this so-called quiet zone of Green Bank, West Virginia. First of all, do you recall how you first came to know about Green Bank, West Virginia, and this so-called quiet zone?
It was as simple as doing a search online for places in the United States without cell service, and up popped the answer of Green Bank, West Virginia, supposedly the quote-unquote quietest town in America.
Hmm. And you tell us that there are actually a number of such radio quiet zones around the world, but that in essentially every other instance of such quiet zones, it is because the place is basically uninhabited for all intents and purposes. And while
while
Green Bank, West Virginia is very sparsely populated, it's by no means uninhabited. So this was going to be, in your mind, the closest place you could come to a place that is inhabited and yet profoundly quiet in this respect. Explain why Green Bank, West Virginia is a so-called radio quiet zone.
So the science of radio astronomy, it's fairly new. It was only discovered back in the 1930s when, kind of by accident, a researcher with Bell Laboratories discovered that he was picking up radio static from space, that space itself is emitting radio waves that are hitting Earth. And that science was kind of evolving over the next decade and through World War II, to the extent that after the war, the National Science Foundation said, we need to do a big investment here in radio astronomy if we want the United States to be at the forefront of this really important burgeoning science. And a search was done of the entire East Coast for what could be the quietest place suitable for our country's very first national radio astronomy observatory. And of about more than 30 sites that they had on the shortlist, Green Bank came out on top. It's in the Appalachian Mountains. It's surrounded by a noise-canceling ring of mountains. Green Bank actually sits in a valley, and mountains up to nearly 5,000 feet tall surround it. And they act as a natural barrier against the outside world's noise. So it's naturally quiet there. And then in 1956, West Virginia passed a state law saying within 10 miles of this astronomy observatory, it's going to be illegal to emit any electromagnetic interference that might interfere with the telescopes. 2 years later, in 1958, the U.S. Congress itself passed another law establishing a national radio quiet zone. This is a 13,000 square mile area, the size of Connecticut and Massachusetts combined, that covers West Virginia, Virginia, and a little piece of Maryland. And any kind of installation, cell tower, radio tower, two-way radio, it all has to be approved. If it's going in that area, it has to first be approved by the quiet zone administrator who operates out of the Green Bank Observatory. So it's an area that you couldn't establish this kind of thing today, right? It was only possible because the state and federal governments had such foresight to think, this is quiet, we need to make sure that it stays quiet. It's like establishing a national park that we don't want to see developed and to disappear. So it established this quiet zone, and it's the reality now that you probably couldn't create another one today. You just can't go into an area and say, okay, everybody give up your devices, turn off all your motors. We need to have a quiet zone here now. People are too attached to that. So it's a unique place in the world. Other quiet zones, it was the very first quiet zone in the world. Others have been created over the past decades. But like you said, they're in super remote, essentially uninhabited places. For example, Australia has a quiet zone. And at last count, it had a human population of two people in this massive area out in the Australian desert.
Wow.
China also has a quiet zone around its 500-meter telescope, a massive dish. I think it's in Sichuan province. But they relocated thousands of people. They just took them out of the area and moved them miles and miles away so that they would not live in the quiet zone. So it's also in an uninhabited area. By contrast, Green Bank, you've got a school that butts up to the observatory. You've got houses right across the street. It's in a real living community. And that makes it a real interesting case study of what does it mean to live more quietly.
Hmm. So just to clarify, because this was built so long ago and this quiet zone created so long ago, this quiet zone was created before anyone had even imagined the technologies that we now very much take for granted, that are just pervasive in modern society. But the way this quiet zone was created, the verbiage, in a sense, was protective even against technologies that at that time did not yet exist.
That's a real sticky point. That's a debate within the astronomy community and within the people who debate those kinds of laws that I find myself kind of stumbling into. When I first arrived to Green Bank, I was told in no uncertain terms that Wi-Fi was illegal, that smartphones were illegal. But then over the coming months and then years that I spent revisiting this place, I found that everybody seems to carry a smartphone. Everybody seems to have Wi-Fi in Green Bank and the surrounding town. So if they all have it, is it really illegal? And asking various people in the observatory, I found that some said that no, it's not illegal. That the state law and the federal law, they don't explicitly mention Wi-Fi. They don't explicitly mention smartphones. Like you said, they just didn't exist back in the 1950s when these laws were created. And there's real debate whether or not the state law or the federal law could even apply to an intentional, non-fixed transmitter such as Wi-Fi or such as a smartphone, and who actually can control whether those things are on or off. There is this threat within that 10-mile radius of the observatory of giving a $50 a day fine to rule breakers, to people who emit interference towards the telescopes. But it's in reality the case that fine has never been levied. The observatory has never actually tested the law or asked the county prosecutor to go after rule breakers. In past decades, it was like a goodwill thing within the community where they were willing to cooperate. And they also didn't have gadgets that purposely were sending out interference. You know, they might have a radio that was malfunctioning, or a static fence, or a TV that had static on it. All those things are causing unintended interference. And so a technician from the observatory would come on over to your house and he'd say, can I fix your radio? And he'd fix it. And both the house, the neighbors were happy to have their radio fixed. And the observatory was happy to not have that interference anymore. But it changes in the past 10 years or so when it's Wi-Fi, when it's something that this house wants to have, that they perhaps see as being necessary to living in modern society. And the observatory is saying, we'd rather you not have that. And the observatory started to back away from that idea of like knocking on doors and banging on houses and saying, we don't want you to have this anymore.
Mm. You quote the state law at one point in the book in a really interesting chapter called A Low Roar. The state law states this: it shall be illegal to operate or cause to be operated any electrical equipment within a 2-mile radius of the reception equipment of any radio astronomy facility if such operation causes interference with reception by said radio astronomy facility of radio waves emanating from any non-terrestrial source. But then you speak with somebody else who believes the state law applied only to incidental, non-intended radiation, such as from a neon sign or an electric fence, and the fact that Wi-Fi is an intentional transmitter would put it under the auspices of the FCC, and that makes it a different matter because state governments have no power to control radio transmissions, including Wi-Fi. So it really is, legally speaking, kind of a sticky wicket. And from the sounds of it, it sounds like a sticky wicket that has not yet been fully resolved.
That's right. It's also a sticky wicket that I had never been aware existed. Most articles and media spots about the Quiet Zone and about Green Bank just flatly say, welcome to the town where Wi-Fi and cell phones are illegal. When in reality, I found, it's hardly determined whether or not it's illegal. It's never been tested in a court of law. That lawsuit has never been brought. I go on to say in that chapter how, you know, maybe this whole debate is somewhat removed from reality in any case, due to the fact that the Green Bank Observatory faces waning financial support from the National Science Foundation. It was actually the case in the past few years that the National Science Foundation actually considered mothballing the entire Green Bank facility. And this is really scary because in Green Bank, you have the Robert C. Byrd Green Bank Telescope. It is the largest object in all of West Virginia. It's nearly 500 feet tall. It's the largest fully steerable telescope in the entire world. It's especially notable because last year, the Arecibo Telescope in Puerto Rico, which is even bigger than the Green Bank Telescope, it collapsed on itself. It's no longer functional, which means that it's even more important for the Green Bank Telescope to be able to do its work. So to have the National Science Foundation all of a sudden saying, we don't want to give the money anymore for this facility is especially scary. And so the Green Bank Observatory has to think, how am I going to survive here? I need to scrape together funds just to, you know, pay my employees, just to keep this telescope running. I don't necessarily have the extra cash to hire a lawyer and to go around town prosecuting people with Wi-Fi. It's really on the observatory to try and just maintain good relations with the community and to get their goodwill, to get them to voluntarily keep the quiet there.
Right, to at least curb their use of some of these technologies.
That's the hope.
What did the scientists, and I know you spoke with some of them, what did they tell you about the actual interference in their work that the presence of Wi-Fi creates? I mean, is it in fact a serious detriment in terms of the work that they are trying to do, in terms of the kind of listening that they are trying to do to radio waves coming to us from the heavens?
Wi-Fi operates in the 2.4 gigahertz frequency. It's that one specific band. I've been told that it's essentially impossible for the radio astronomers to do their work in the 2.4 gigahertz frequency anymore. They've just lost access to that band of the radio universe. If a star is emitting in that band toward Earth, the Green Bank Telescope can't pick it up. There's just too much interference from the surrounding community. To give you a sense of how difficult it is already to do these readings, you know, it's all digital now with the readings from the telescope, but it used to be a paper chart. And so you can see these paper charts, and it just looks like a scribble of lines that the telescope is picking up, you know, from these invisible energy waves. And the evidence that they're looking for, what's happening out in space, is just like the tiniest little like extra bump among all those scribbles of noise. And so if you can imagine, if you have Wi-Fi in the surrounding community, all of those surrounding scribbles just amp up, and you can't discern that little extra blip that might be from the pulsar or from the colliding black holes or from other cosmic events that might be out there in the universe. the observatory is also, it's part of the world's longest search for extraterrestrial intelligence. The world's very first official hunt was done there in Green Bank by an astronomer named Frank Drake back in 1960. And the observatory is still at the forefront of scanning the skies, looking for potential signs of ET. If ET calls at that 2.4 gigahertz frequency, we're not going to get the message.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Stephen Kersey about his book, The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. The town in question, which I think is actually not, in fact, an official town, but more of just a small community or village, is that of Green Bank, West Virginia, adjacent to the Green Bank Observatory. Stephen Kersey, you described yourself as embedding yourself in this area of West Virginia. I mean, coming to visit and staying for an extended period of time and coming back for visits, unlike the kind of typical media visits that you recount in your book, in which people come in and kind of take the place at face value. You were interested in doing more than that. Tell us the extent to which you attempted to embed yourself in the life and culture of Green Bank, West Virginia.
I first went there in March of 2017, just for a long weekend. Over the coming 3 years, I went back about a dozen times, and I spent about 4 months living there on the ground in the Green Bank area for visits as long as for a full month at a time. I spent Christmas, Thanksgiving, New Year's, major holidays with the people there in Green Bank. I went target shooting with a seven-year-old. I tasted the local moonshine. I went square dancing with the old ladies in town. I helped build a house. I learned how to forage for ramps. I really tried to experience the culture in every single season and in every single facet, from the observatory to the farmers to going into the schools a number of times, to feel what the area is like and get a sense of how these various people all kind of exist in a quiet zone. Mm. And it came to be the fact that the surrounding culture was just as interesting, if not more so, than what was happening at the observatory itself. The observatory was my reason for going there, and the quiet zone was my reason for going there. But then I started finding that the quiet, this last quiet area, this great quiet swath of Appalachia, has had like a magnetizing, attracting force over the past half century, pulling in a number of people and groups who have been looking to get away from it all and kind of fly under the radar.
Hmm. One of the things you say in one chapter is, it's hard to be an outsider in Pocahontas, and that means Pocahontas County. I heard myriad iterations of the phrase, if you haven't been here for six generations, you're still a newcomer. At first it sounded quaint, a note of pride in how families had settled the land, but it also hinted at how residents could be dismissive toward new people and new ideas, as if to say, we don't care what you think because you're not from here. And of course, what you're pointing to there is, for instance, when people move there for whatever reason, they might be greeted by this attitude. And certainly you, as a journalist, I should think, might be greeted with this kind of attitude as well. Or did it help that you were a journalist and that you were, in a sense, there for that particular purpose? I mean, how were you greeted and how open were you about the fact that you were a journalist engaged in trying to write about this area and its people?
Well, as a part of my own code of ethics, I was always very upfront with, I'm a journalist, I'm working on a book about Green Bank, and I want you to know that, just because I wanted them to be clear that anything that they told me, might eventually end up in this book. There was a mix of people kind of giving me the brush off to assuming that I was just here like any other journalist, coming in for a day or two and then disappearing. And then people who perhaps wanted to play into the facade of what they thought outsiders wanted green bank to be in their minds. As an example of that, I can remember being at the local general store. It's called Trent's General Store. I kind of became like a longtime patron there. I would just hang out next to the register where an older woman named Betty Molinax had been checking out patrons for the past half century. She's been working there. So you get a real flavor for the area. And while I was at Trent's one time, I saw a local minister. He's a brethren minister. He was there with his son. And his son had already told me that their home in Greenbank didn't have Wi-Fi. So I saw him and his dad. I was like, hey, just wanted to catch up and see if you still don't have Wi-Fi. He's like, yeah, we don't. I'm like, oh, really? Because I'm hearing that more and more people actually do have Wi-Fi around town. But you guys don't. I kind of like said it like, really? Like, are you really telling me the truth here? And they kind of like looked at me, kind of like twisted their heads like quizzically. And then the dad's like, well, actually, yeah, we do have Wi-Fi. So he was like a brethren minister, a man of God, who was willing to lie to me about whether or not they had Wi-Fi. It took being there, you know, for months, over years, to be able to like ask those questions and to know when to push people a little bit more to discover that like what the reality actually was there wasn't perhaps what they were originally willing to tell an outsider.
What was really intriguing to me is that among the people who have secured Wi-Fi for themselves in their homes are even some of the people who are charged with going around and finding Wi-Fi where it is not supposed to be. I mean, even those charged with policing this matter themselves had secured Wi-Fi in one way or another. How disappointing was it to you to discover that the quiet zone was not, in fact, as quiet as it was?
Yeah, I remember you're referring there to a man named Chuck Nyge. He's known as the Quiet Zone Cop. So he works at the observatory, and every couple weeks he gets into this truck, which has about 17 antennas sticking out of the roof. And those antennas act as like a direction-finding array that allow him to hunt down sources of renegade radio frequency interference in the surrounding area. And that summer of 2017, I went on a ride around with him looking for RFI, for radio frequency interference. And before even getting out of the observatory's parking lot, we found about a half dozen Wi-Fi signals. And then over the next hour or two driving around the surrounding area, we picked up nearly 200 Wi-Fi signals. By 2019, it was the fact that those signals, there were more signals than houses in that surrounding area, if that was even possible. And Chuck told me that it didn't matter what godforsaken dirt road he went down in the middle of those Appalachian mountains, he'd get to the house and it seemed like even they had Wi-Fi. It becomes so pervasive. There is this feeling, there was like a realization through that we just can't get away from the tech revolution. We can't get away from this technology, which is increasingly coming to be an integral part of our lives. Even out there in the quiet zone, they feel this need to have Wi-Fi, even if their internet is still slow, even if that Wi-Fi doesn't really enable them to, you know, stream a video over their smartphone, they still feel like they need to have Wi-Fi so they can be connected when they're around the house or walking around the yard. And it highlights how, despite this fascination in the media with an idea that Greenbank is doing the fight for the rest of us, that there's this one quiet place in the world where they still are maybe a little bit more human. They're still a little bit more like the way we used to live just 20 years ago, and that they're doing the good fight for the rest of us, even if we can't stay off our devices. It's not the case. Even in Greenbank, they're struggling with how to manage that being online versus offline and how to manage that role that tech is increasingly taking in our lives.
Right.
And it pushes the onus really back on us to find the quiet in our own lives. We can't leave it up to Greenbank. We can't just go to Greenbank and expect to be totally offline. We have to do the hard work here on our own.
Would it be safe to say that the typical person in Greenbank, West Virginia, even those who have secured Wi-Fi, are nevertheless not tethered to it and dependent on it the way that most of us are in our daily lives? I mean, is it
despite
a,
finding
Is it a more limited presence in their lives, if for no other reason than because of the rather low quality of that Wi-Fi?
That's a good point to make, because despite the fact that there was a lot more Wi-Fi and smartphones in the Green Bank area and around Pocahontas County than I'd expected to find, it's still the case that it's a more disconnected area. There's still no cell service in Green Bank, and I think in the entire county at last count, there was something like 9 limited low-power cell phone antennas. So there's only specific small pockets. And as to highlight how limited it is, you know, for people who live in a certain area, they'll know that one road, that one bend in the road where they can go to get a bar of cell service. And so sometimes you'll see just a row of cars lined up, and they all have like their phones sticking out the window because they're trying to tap into cell service before they go back home, before they're back in the quiet zone, essentially. Like, they still can't text and drive. They still can't talk on the phone and drive. It's still the case that when they walk out of the house, they're back in the quiet zone. It's not going to be a device that follows you all around. And for my wife and I, when we went there actually for a two-week stay over Christmas and New Year's one time. I don't have a cell phone, but my wife has two. One is personal, and one is mandated that she carry around all the time by her employer. And so for her, it was a real test of, like, is what's it going to be like all of a sudden not to have cell service, not to be connected all the time? And it took her about a full week before she stopped taking out her device and just habitually swiping it to check if she had messages, even though she knew in her mind that nothing was going to be new because she didn't have Wi-Fi or cell service. Like, it took her a week to break away from that. And people who live there, they just don't have as much of that instinctual need to touch their device all the time or to be connected quite all the time.
So there is, in a sense, some quiet there, if not the perfect quiet that the headlines would suggest. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Stephen Kersey. We're talking about his fascinating new book called The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence. Your book is about much more than just the presence or lack of it in our lives and the presence of technology or the lack of it in this so-called quiet zone. But your book is also about, as you said earlier, about how this region has served as something of a magnet for a lot of interesting people. And among them is quite a number of people that have come to be known as electrosensitives, people who believe that they are highly sensitive in a negative way to the effects of some of these technologies that are otherwise all around us. Tell us more about the electrosensitives and some of them that you had the chance to meet and engage with.
Sure. Since really the advent of cell antennas and smartphones, there have been an increasing number of people around the world who believe that they're physically harmed, that they can physically sense when they're near a cell antenna or near a smartphone or near Wi-Fi. And it's more than just they can sense when it's on or when they're near it. They feel physical pain to the point of, like, debilitating illness and even being put in a hospital. I spoke with one woman who had fled, essentially, to Green Bank. She had traveled around the world in search of a quiet place only to discover that Green Bank may be her last refuge in this noisy world, because it's protected by these state and federal laws and that it's isolated by those noise-canceling mountains. She believes that Green Bank was her last refuge, and she showed me a picture of herself actually at her sickest time when she was on a hospital bed, losing weight, kind of fighting for her life. Hundreds of these people have come to Green Bank from around the world. I met a woman from France who was, you know, camping in the woods because she thought, this is all my only option right now. You know, women from Iowa, from around the country, people from Europe, from Japan, have all come to Green Bank. It's the case that for the local economy, they have actually pushed up housing prices. And there's been this quiet zone real estate that has popped up to cater to these people. If you look in the local newspaper, every week or so, you'll just see like a new listing for great property in the quiet zone, you know, close to the observatory, very quiet. And it's these properties that are being catered to these people with natural sensitivity. So much the case that I think it was like 200 homes the manager of this real estate company told me had been sold in the past decade to people who are electrosensitive. 200 homes sold, and that's not even including the number of people who come through for short visits or just to recuperate and then leave that area, or people who are just renting homes. You can imagine this is a somewhat difficult illness for a lot of us to understand, right? Like, I have Wi-Fi at my house. You're talking on a radio. There's lots of electromagnetic radiation around both of us right now, but we can't feel that. And I assume that neither one of us feel sick, nor people on their radios listening right now. So if we have a hard time understanding it, how much more challenging would it be for this remote, somewhat insular pocket of Appalachia where they're not always welcoming of outsiders and outside ideas? So to have somebody come in who's not from that place and all of a sudden say, you all have to turn off your Wi-Fi. And that's happening. Some of these electrosensitives actually go up to people's doors, knock on them and say, I can tell you have Wi-Fi, you have to turn it off. Or they'll go to the library and say, these light bulbs are bothering me, you have to change the light bulbs or you have to turn off the lights for me. That's happened at the library, it's happened at the local general store, it's happened even at the senior citizen center, where one woman, actually, she was bothered by the fish tank there as well. And she unplugged the fish tank, the air filter that was providing bubbles. It didn't cause her harm anymore, but it killed all the fish. And this was a problem for people at the senior center. Like, who are these outsiders coming in and killing our fish and telling us how to live? It's kind of calmed down. It's more difficult in past years where some of these electrosensitives were more demanding in how they thought the community needed to adapt for them. But it's still, they're bubbling under the surface. Another interesting aspect of this is that the electrosensitives, they truly want this area to be quiet. They want it to remain quiet, even if the surrounding community isn't so excited about it being quiet anymore because they want to have access to this modern technology. But you have these newcomers coming in, and really, they are great neighbors to the Radio Astronomy Observatory, which is fighting for the area to be quiet for the sake of the science that they're doing. And so you have kind of this strange alliance arising between these scientists who are doing their great astronomy work and the electrosensitives who are coming in from around the world.
It's really fascinating, and it's so interesting to think about people moving into this area and demanding that it not change, that it not modernize, because the reason they came there was because of what they believed it to be, while the people who live there feel like, this is our home. This was already our home before you got here, and we have the right to evolve and change as we see fit. These electrosensitives, as they're called, would probably count among what you describe at one point in your book as an impossible menagerie of eccentrics congregating in the forest. Some of them would also be so-called back-to-the-landers, who come to this region to live off the grid. But a darker manifestation of this would be also the large number of neo-Nazis that live in this region, and the presence of something, a neo-Nazi organization called the National Alliance. You actually stepped on the grounds of their compound and met one of their leaders named David Pringle. Tell us how you were able to make sense of the presence of something as disquieting as this in the so-called quiet zone.
So the National Alliance, for context, it's not just some random group of, neo-Nazi losers hanging out in the woods drinking beer. I still think they're losers, but this is an influential, is considered the most influential and well-organized neo-Nazi formation in all of America for quite a few years through the late 90s and into the 2000s. Its leader and founder until his death in 2002 was William Pierce, considered the godfather of the modern white supremacist movement. He authored a racist novel of evil futurism called The Turner Diaries, which is considered a foundational text for the racist right and also a motivating text for more than 40 incidents of terrorism worldwide most notably here in the United States itself with the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh, who actually had pages of that book, The Turner Diaries, in his car, and who had called the National Alliance the day before a number of times. So William Pierce was expounding that racist philosophy where he wanted to overthrow the U.S. government and install a pro-white regime that would not allow non-whites into this country. He was expounding that polite racist philosophy from deep in the Quiet Zone, just south of Green Bank, for several decades. And so I wanted to find out, how did he end up here? Why the Quiet Zone, of all places, did he choose to establish the headquarters for his organization, which still exists there to this day, in a much smaller and limited form, though, however, it's waned a lot since William Pierce's death. So I went up to the compound, despite some warnings from people in the community and community officials for me to stay away. I remember one community official telling me I was liable to get shot if I went up there and stepped grounds on the compound. But I went anyways. I felt it was kind of like my duty as a journalist to find out what is actually happening here. Are they still here, and what are they doing? And that's where I met David Pringle. I came up this long, mile-long, pockmarked dirt driveway up to the gated compound of National Alliance, where at one point, at its heyday, there were something like two dozen staffers working full-time for this $1 million hate media empire that was selling books, magazines, music records, and other literature to people around the world. So I head up to the gate of this compound, and David Pringle, who's I later found out is a fairly well-known member of the neo-Nazi movement. At one point, he was considered one of the 40 most dangerous leaders on the radical right by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a watchdog group. David Pringle, after checking my ID, and kind of like vetting me to make sure I wasn't, you know, an enemy of sorts, he let me inside the compound and welcomed me onto the back of his four-wheeler and proceeded to give me a seven-hour tour through the compound. Hmm. And that turned into me going back there over and over for the next 3 years to track what's happening with this group, how is Pierce attracted to this area. And it emerged that William Pierce came there not because it was a national radio quiet zone. I don't think he cared whether or not it had electromagnetic radiation, but because it was a quiet place, because it was quiet, it was recognized by quiet by the government back in the 50s, and its quiet was protected by those state and federal laws. It's remained a really quiet place, and that was appealing to the neo-Nazis because it meant there weren't going to be a lot of people. They weren't going to be bothered by the minorities and other groups of people who had bothered them back when they were operating in the Washington, D.C. area, and they could also fly under the radar of law enforcement. There's just not a whole lot of law enforcement. It's not very strong in this area because it's just hard for a single sheriff and a handful of deputies to patrol an area that's the size of Rhode Island. Pocahontas County is one of the largest counties in all of West Virginia, while also being the most sparsely populated. So he retreated to a quiet place that he could get away from it all. And that was really what drew the astronomers to that place, the back-to-the-landers to that place, and even the electrosensitives. They want to be able to exist while also being in their own, you know, pocket where they can get away from the things that are bothering them.
Hmm. Your book goes on to explore other eccentrics who live in the area and a peculiar kind of mountain justice that is at the heart of some unsolved deaths and killings, and also the fascinating and troubling story of the so-called Gesundheit Institute created by one Patch Adams, which about which you uncover some really unsettling realities, and so much more. Since the publication of your book, have you been back to Green Bank, West Virginia, or do you plan to make other visits there?
I've been in contact with the people, and you know, I sent them some books and been trying to, you know, gauge how they feel about it and whether or not it captures their place. And so far, the reception has been really positive. They're happy that a nuanced, complicated portrait of this nuanced, complicated place is finally being put out there. I'll be actually going back next week for a 2-week visit. I'm going to be talking with some book clubs and doing a couple of events and catching up with people who I haven't been able to see over the past 2 years because of COVID.
The book again is The Quiet Zone, Unraveling the Mystery of a Town Suspended in Silence, published by Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow, the author Stephen Kersey. Stephen Kersey, thank you so much for this conversation and for this terrific book.
Great. Thanks so much for all the time. And thank you for the thoughtful questions. Really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I speak with the co-author of a book called Nightmare Scenario, which examines the